Hello and welcome to Political Contessa. This is Jennifer Nassor and I am your Political Contessa.
We're an incredibly high cost state. The cost of housing, the cost of food, the cost of transportation, cost of electricity. And a lot of people who've been longtime residents of Massachusetts are finding themselves in very difficult situations and sometimes homeless. And we need to have the support system there to help them. The other trade-off is when we're spending $1 billion, half of that going to people who are arriving here illegally, it means that we're not supporting other people who have lived here.
Welcome to Political Contessa. I'm Jennifer Nassor, and this show is here to support your interests in center-right politics, policy, and breaking news. Listen in and discover how to awaken your inner ideal candidate, and if you're ready, how you can jump in and change the world as a runner or a supporter. Welcome to Political Contessa. If you or a friend have ever considered running, or you know a woman who should, I've got something just for you. My quick guide called Secrets from the Campaign Trail. It will show you 5 signs to tell you you're ready to enter the political arena. To get these tips and learn about all new podcast episodes and ways to get involved, head over to politicalcontessa.com. So today I have on with me a state rep from Massachusetts. Yes, yes, yes. She's a Republican and a female. We do not have many of these. It's like finding a unicorn, a Republican female lawmaker. But we do have one, and it is my very good friend, Hannah Kane. She is a state rep from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. And we have just a lot going on here in Massachusetts these days. I know all over the country, everyone has your own issues, but we couldn't be further away from the southern border. And we have a migrant crisis. We have an ongoing drug crisis that you would assume it feels like it just came up out of nowhere like a pandemic, but it's been going on for years. We have a crazy mayor who wants to raise taxes on corporations and companies, corporate property. And we have the crazy mayor wants to implement a 2% real estate transfer tax, which actually deals with the legislature because she can't do that. Thank God, because we have a legislature. So Hannah is on with me today to discuss these and other issues affecting a blue state like crazy Massachusetts. So Hannah, welcome.
Thanks, John, for having me. It's great to be on with you.
Well, it's awesome. Thank you for making the time. I know it's a really busy time of year for you. So one of the things I just want to start with, and this I think is really important because this is kind of relates back to Pocketbook Project, which is my heart and soul. And the reason I started the podcast is, can you talk a little bit about what motivated you to run for office in the first place?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I've always been intrigued by public service. I grew up in Maine. There were several women that were very impactful to me young, thinking about the role of public service. Margaret Chase Smith, the first woman to serve in the U.S. House and U.S. Senate. Really long track record, a moderate Republican, broke rank with the party when she felt it was in the interest for her constituents. And so I've always wanted to serve. And I'm also a former business owner. So I come at it with a little bit of a different perspective than many of my colleagues. Some of them are lawyers. A lot of them at this point are young and are coming sort of right out of school and first jobs. And so they don't have some of that in-depth experience. And so I felt it was important to be somebody who's been on the receiving end of a lot of state laws and rules and regulations, having owned a construction business, to be on the inside and understanding the laws that we're considering, how they impact business owners. And I've also been involved in local government. So I've seen it from the municipal side as well, understanding what's happening on Beacon Hill and the impacts that happen at a local level.
I think that's awesome. And you're a mom and a wife and an active member of your community, and it empowered you to run for office. And I think you were one of the best up there on Beacon Hill.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I also said when I ran that tone and tenor matter, right? So I've done a lot in the community. I led a lot of community issues And I was successful. The people that I helped run their races, they were successful because of the way that we approached it. And I didn't want to go to Beacon Hill to blow everything up. I wanted to go to Beacon Hill to find a way to be an impactful member. We're the minority party, right? So we can't just say, well, this is what we think, and then it becomes law. We really have to be very knowledgeable about the issues to have key relationships built over time and credibility. And so you mentioned being a Republican woman on Beacon Hill. Of the 200 members, there's only 4 Republican women. So we are very rare there. The flip side of that is we get to be in a lot more conversations when they want to make something bipartisan or inclusive. So we have in sort of an outsized mode to communicate what our priorities as Republicans are and to find pathways to help make some of them a reality.
So, you know what, I think that's a really interesting statement that you made, because I think a lot of people, a lot of women especially, right, we know women have to be asked 7 times before they actually run for office. And it's always, and that's why I point out that you're a mom. And because at the end of the day, I think that a lot of women don't feel like now is the right time. But then also, if you live in a state, you live in a red state, you're a Democrat. You live in a blue state, you're a Republican. It's like, oh, what am I going to be able to do? But I think you make a really good point that because you are so much in the minority as a female and as a Republican in a very blue Democratic controlled state, you have a seat at a lot more tables than you would if you were in the supermajority, because then you're just one of the other 156 in the house.
I participate in Women in Government, the national foundation that hosts legislator conferences for women legislators. And when we go, other states are always actually amazed, because in the Massachusetts delegation of women there, you have no idea who's a Republican or Democrat just by sort of watching us. Because yes, we belong to different parties, but most of us have a lot of respect for each other and what we bring to the table. And we try and find pathway forward. We're not always going to agree, but women are really good at trying to find common ground and a path forward. And so I do enjoy really the opportunity to work with all legislators, but women in particular, it's been a lot of fun.
Awesome. All right, let's get into it.
Absolutely.
Okay. So a friend of mine is just took off and went to Europe out of Terminal E at Boston Logan Airport and sent me a picture of the migrants that live in the airport, sleep in the airport at night. It's sad. It is. And it's definitely an issue that needs to be addressed. Massachusetts, we're a sanctuary state, right? And we have this right to shelter law. Can you talk a little bit about the migrant crisis and what it means to be a sanctuary state and have this right to shelter law going on right now? What's going to happen? What do you think?
Sure. I mean, the right to shelter law was a well-intentioned law that came about in the 80s when we were closing a lot of our homes where people with developmental disabilities, mental health issues were, and were sort of being turned back out into the community and many ending up back on the streets. And so this law was put in place to ensure that women and families with children didn't end up on the streets. It was never envisioned to be used in this situation where we have people coming in from outside of the country seeking asylum. Many of them, as you said, they're fleeing horrible situations like Haiti. It's despicable what's happening there. So you naturally understand why they want to leave. But we as a country, being a country that has rules and laws, need to actually enforce them. And so we need legal immigration in our country. We have always needed it, and we always will need it to fulfill many of the roles, both at the top of the sort of economic spectrum, very highly educated, talented people coming here to help with companies. My neighbor for many years came from England originally to work at Raytheon, ended up becoming a US citizen over time, going through the legal pathway to do so. And we also need people to come here and work in many, particularly in a good economy, lower paying jobs that we don't have enough. So immigration itself is not a dirty word, right? We as a country have always had it and need to have it, but it needs to come through legal means. When we have illegal immigration, hurting everybody, not just the people who currently live here, but other people waiting outside of the country to come through in a legal manner. And the reality is we can't afford $1 billion a year here just in Massachusetts to help house people on an emergency basis and to provide the other supports that they get when they come here. About half of the population that's in our emergency shelters right now are people who were living here before. They're not illegally coming here. Because we're an incredibly high cost state, the cost of housing, the cost of food, the cost of transportation, cost of electricity. And a lot of people who've been longtime residents of Massachusetts are finding themselves in very difficult situations and sometimes homeless. And we need to have the support system there to help them. And so the other trade-off is when we're spending $1 billion, half of that going to people who are just arriving here illegally, it means that we're not supporting other people who have lived here or who are on the cusp of losing their housing. They're in that difficult situation. They're not quite homeless, but they need help. So we have to recognize that there's a trade-off in this spending as well. It wasn't as if this money was just sitting in an account and we thought we have nothing better to do with this.
I'm laughing at that last statement, like a state having a bit, by the way, this is the $1 billion, let's be clear, is just in Massachusetts. That is not in the United States. That's just Massachusetts. We are a very small state. I mean, we have under 7 million people that live in the Commonwealth. So it's not like we're this big state. We are a very wealthy state, but $1 billion is $1 billion. And going to what you were saying, I mean, when they emptied out, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, the Molina Cass Recreation Center in Roxbury, and you have a rec center that is used for inner city kids that need to be off the streets, kids that need supervision, but they also need recreation to keep them away from drug dealers and from gang violence and out of their house because they don't have the support system at home, right? And they sent those kids away and they brought in what, 200 or 300 migrants to go there. So now you're bringing in migrants who haven't had background checks. There's a public safety hazard that occurs here. It's already a tough neighborhood. And now you're just throwing them into this neighborhood that really can't accommodate them. But, you know, again, even more, I think, offensive to me as a taxpayer is our elderly, our veterans, our soft space in my heart for single moms that are trying to provide for their children and are working two jobs, or just any family that has fallen on hard times, or any person who has fallen on hard times. You're getting bumped by the system that you have paid into, or you're trying to move up out of your level by these people who have come in to our country, came over the border illegally, walked past every single law that and regulation and rule, and didn't do what your neighbor, didn't do what my ancestors did, my grandparents did, or anyone else that we know who came here and skipped the line. And now we're spending $1 billion a year. I find that so offensive as a taxpayer. And I just, like, what is the conversation in the legislature about this? Because we can all talk about it, but what's the conversation that goes on up there, especially with the Democrats?
Yeah. So, you know, the other challenge of it, right, is so people come here and we get them into this emergency housing, this shelter system, and then it's taking the Biden administration forever to get work permits for these folks. So, again, many of them, we have a shelter in Shrewsbury. They want to work. They want to get out of this. They don't like living in the hotel room, many of them, any more than anyone else would for an expanded period of time. It's not easy, right? So they're trying to get on their feet. They can't get a work permit. So I do appreciate the governor pressing the Biden administration to get people here to help people get work permits so they can go get a job. By the way, we have jobs they could fill. Salem Hospital, I think for the first time, is filled with orderlies and people to deliver food and do jobs that they haven't been able to fill. But they also, the challenge is getting them out of this emergency shelter system because there is no housing for anybody who's looking to not pay a lot, right? Because rent is so high. So we have these other forces that are also sort of keeping them in the shelter system that are working against us. For us in the legislature, I mean, the Republicans, every time a bill has been brought up to fund this, we have filed amendments. Almost a year ago, we filed an amendment to say that you had to live in the Commonwealth for a year. You had to be a resident for a year in order to access the services. That wasn't accepted. We changed it to 6 months the next time and said, okay, you have to live here for 6 months. That wasn't accepted. We changed it to 3 months. I mean, the law, that the right to shelter laws, has the word resident in it, but the interpretation that's being used is essentially you put your foot down on soil in Massachusetts, you're a resident.
Versus that's crazy.
Our perspective is residents should have some continuum of time here. And by the way, we had caveats for domestic violence or a natural disaster, things that are obviously going to occur to people that could, you could be here a month under the best of circumstances and have a tragedy. We're not trying to block. But part of the reason we filed these is to sort of preempt a conversation, right? Like, what is the plan? Like, we can't just continue in this way. And it's difficult because the federal government has a huge, much bigger role in this in the scheme of things, and they are doing almost nothing. So, but what can we do here in Massachusetts? Because we've also been fortunate the last couple of years, tax revenue has been relatively healthy compared to what we thought would happen when COVID struck. But it's not going to stay that way. This year's been dicey. We were down quite a bit in the beginning. We're up a little bit. But, you know, we can't just spend $1 billion a year every year. That's ridiculous. We've also done some other things. The Republicans, when we were debating the state budget, we filed an amendment to eliminate the $35 million included in the House budget to subsidize the free phone calls for prisoners. Mm. It's like, okay, what becomes the priorities here? Like, you can't just add this spending on without having some conversations about what comes off or what changes. And I think most of our perspective is, let's not try and eliminate the things that, again, are supporting people in crisis who have lived here, who have been longtime residents, who are either the single moms trying to stay in housing, an elderly person trying to stay in their housing or access services. Let's not take the dollars there. But let's think about some ways to manage this crisis.
Absolutely. I appreciate that you guys are doing that, because it's tough to carry the water when you're in such a small minority up there. But, you know, you bring up a good point. So you're talking about $1 billion and where are we going to keep getting this money without cutting something else or doing something else, which, of course, it's never, or it doesn't feel like it is ever. You obviously know better than I do, but it feels like we rarely see anything get cut. What we see instead is implementing new taxes. So go back to the millionaire's tax, right? And how that affected. So yes, they're collecting a good amount of revenue on the millionaire's tax, but how many people have already left the state? And what is the trajectory for that money when we see that young people between the ages of 25 and 40 are leaving Massachusetts? We're an aging population state, which we know what happens when you age, and it's an expensive environment, right? It's an expensive state. The weather is not really preferable to people who are older. So what is going to happen over time if they're not reining in costs for the migrants and this $1 billion a year? We're not taking care of the people we should be taking care of. We have this aging population. They don't want to stop at the millionaire's tax. I want to talk about the real estate transfer fee and all of that. But what the heck is going on? I mean, when does the well run dry? And then there are serious issues here.
Yeah, I mean, some of that is what happens when you have super majorities and you have progressive leadership like you do in the city of Boston. And I think we have already seen this, as you mentioned, the key age group of 25 to sort of 35, 40 year olds leaving our state. I have two daughters, 23 and almost 22, and a son who's almost 19. I don't know if they're going to be able to afford. And they're lucky. They've been able to, they've gone to college, like they've been set up for success in life. And yet I don't know that they can afford to stay here, particularly in their young, starting out years on their professional journeys. And we don't have any plan to change that, right? Like, there's nothing that we're doing at the moment that I think is going to make deep inroads into that. We did a tax package last year, which Charlie had proposed when Governor Baker was there. Couldn't be dealt with. It was impossible. Governor Healey got elected, filed largely the same tax package, fortunately, and we were able to do it. We did about $1 billion in tax cuts, and it hit many different groups, which was a positive of it. But we've still fell to being 46th in the country in terms of worst taxes, even with that $1 billion tax cut. So when you look at the environment that you're asking young people to begin their professional or work going right into the career force out of high school, they can't make ends meet, and we're not making it any easier for them. So we have a lot of work to do here in the Commonwealth to figure out how do we go from an extremely high cost state to one in which it welcomes young people. Because if we don't, our whole economic underpinning is gone. And now we are a state that relies on a lot of knowledge economy, which everyone learned during COVID how easy it is to just move that anywhere. You don't have to live here in Massachusetts to work at Fidelity or to work at some other financial institution. And so I just don't think we're still trying to figure out how to get a commuter rail to run and how to fix potholes. And the rest of the world is figuring out how to recruit these talented young people. And by the way, it's not just, again, the upper ends of the professional world. We don't have enough plumbers, electricians, the trades. Like, we're losing people in all of the different career categories that we need to be here to have a healthy economy.
I mean, it's, and I definitely see it's a problem. I mean, my kids are essentially, my older ones are essentially the same age. And my daughter would love to come back here after college. And I keep saying to her, I don't know, in North Carolina, businesses are going down there. The taxes are better. The weather is better. Why would you come back here to move to South Boston? Yes, all the 20-year-olds live there, but it's $4,000 a month for rent. And you don't necessarily need to live in the city. So many of the jobs are remote, can be remote, or you're there a couple of days a week. And I just, it's hard to see how they come back, but it will hurt our bottom line because for us, our age group, we're here, right? We're here. This is our where our families are. But if you have little kids and you're trying to buy a home for what's the medium housing cost right now, $1 million, 900,000,
Crazy.
right? It's crazy. So if you are a young family and you're trying to buy a home to fit your family of two kids or three kids or whatever it is, you almost get priced out. And going to what you're saying, hey, newsflash for anyone who doesn't live in Massachusetts, we don't have a great transportation system. It is actually terrible. So we don't have the infrastructure in place. We have more traffic. And so when you look at everything, you say, there are other places I can go and have a much better quality of life. And more people go, schools get better, right? More planned communities. It's just tough. And I give you guys, the Republicans in the state legislature, so much credit for pointing all of these things out, because it's almost like it falls on deaf ears that they just think that there's a money tree out there and just keeps growing.
There is, and to your earlier sort of question around like the transfer tax, we just did the housing bond bill last week in the House. It was over $6 billion, divided over many years, and that's just authorized. It doesn't mean it's all going to be spent. But I was very happy that the Speaker of the House did not include in the House bill the transfer tax, which he got a lot of incoming expecting it to be included in that. And was very happy that it wasn't included in there. Now the bill is going to the Senate, and I know that there are Senate colleagues on the Democratic side who are going to file amendments if it's not included in their bill that comes out. But that even in a supermajority, you have different ends of the political spectrum. And so there's that pressure, particularly from the progressive end, for a lot of these initiatives. And sometimes I laugh when people say, oh, the Speaker of the House doesn't want any Republicans elected. I think, no, like, to some extent, it's also about, you do need some balance there, but you right. also need to prevent within your own party having the very progressive end of it have an outweighted voice. 61% of the Massachusetts voters are unenrolled. So you've got to find, at the end of the day, there's got to be some things that are done that are more center of the road in a blue state, you know, not center road in a red state, but center of the road in a blue state, and have some balance there. And so it's always important for the Republicans to show up and to have a voice in this, but also to provide sort of that opening for this center conversation, this moderate conversation to occur.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and that chunk of unenrolled voters, right, that consider themselves to be independent, needs to start paying attention. Like, it's one thing to say that you're independent, and for someone like me to say, well, if they wanted to be Democrats, they could be Democrats. But when we see voting patterns, we see the lackadaisical voting in primaries, and how the far reaches of both parties end up making it through primaries, it becomes really scary and concerning. And so I hope it continues to be that way, that in a supermajority, because we're not going to change that anytime very soon or quickly, but that you still have the range, the range of political spectrum of views in there. So you still have more conservative Democrats, right, who still are looking at fiscal issues and how it's affecting our Commonwealth and going forward. But it is concerning. I mean, and something like the real estate transfer thing, I mean, again, going back to the housing costs, if you're paying $900,000 for a home, you know, what happens to the person who pays $2 million, right? That becomes a lot of money for someone, especially if this is your nest egg, if right. this is your retirement and that's all you have. And it's just, and again, what are we doing with the money? So I just think that there's so many issues that we have here. Those two are kind of those are two of my bees in my bonnet.
Yeah.
So what else do you see coming up on Beacon Hill in the coming week?
Well, we have a laundry list of things that we need to take up before the end of July. Some bills have passed in one chamber, like we did the housing bond bill last week. The Senate needs to do it. The budget isn't done yet. That's being negotiated in conference committee. We have an huge economic development bill that we need to do, reauthorizing the life science initiative, like lots of big things. We also have a lot of smaller money-wise or policy-wise, but also incredibly important bills coming up. I'm looking forward to the fact we have one of mine coming up tomorrow on the Parentage Act, which...
Yeah, talk about that a little bit.
So our parentage laws haven't been updated in 40 years. So in 1973, everything was a man and a woman. And we've had 20 years of legal gay marriage here in the Commonwealth, and we haven't updated our laws to reflect what family structures look like today. And so we're the last state in New England. So every time somebody tells me how like progressive we are here in the Commonwealth, I bring up a laundry list of bills of which we are the last in New England or beyond for having done. And here in New England, we're the last state to take up this law. And so we'll vote on that tomorrow, which I'm happy about. But, you know, the sad thing is there are so many good bills. Actually, there's a ton of bills that are always scary and you're hoping they never come up. There's also just a ton of good bills that have to get filed session after session. And if you operate like a business, you would be knocking your head against the wall because you're like, why is it Groundhog Day? Like every 2 years on this, all the same energy, all the same advocates coming in. So I always hope that as we get to this point in session, there's some smaller bills that are just good policy that should be advanced and put through, and then we're done dealing with it. We don't have to refile and do all of this again next session.
Yeah. I think number one, your bill, I think is great. I think it should be more reflective of the times of where we are in society, and that people, the world of couples and families, right? We want to encourage families. And
we don't even have anything. Our laws, assisted reproduction, surrogacy, not part of our statutes, because it's, again, 40 some years ago in terms of reflecting how legal parentage comes into being. So again, it's kind of it's a no-brainer, but it's a bill that took a lot of advocacy, not necessarily because of the policy question, but to rise above the fray and get noticed to be like, okay, you're right. Let's do this now.
That's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing that it's like even a question, right? Of being recognized and having this out there. And again, you know what? I think it shows who you are as a person and as a legislator, but the thoughtfulness behind the bill. And I think it also shows that Republicans aren't against everything. Republicans are for things. And one of the things that we're for are family values and a family nucleus. And this is all part of it, whether it's same sex or heterosexual, it doesn't matter.
And by the way, it means that you don't have to go adopt your own child in the courts and take up the court time and pay thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars to do so. So, I mean, there's also, again, philosophically, it's completely the right thing to do. Policy-wise, it's the right thing to do. But there's always a financial piece.
Yes.
You know, courts have a huge backlog. Like, so we're having these things have to go through the court system when they don't need to. We just need to update our laws. And the Supreme Judicial Court's been asking for 20 years in Massachusetts for us to update this policy, because they have to rely on what's in statute. They can't make it up, or they shouldn't make it up as they go along. They should be looking to statute. And again, this is another example of where they're like, you need to update these laws. We can't see all these cases. It's crazy.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Well, thank you for doing that. I think it's great. And there's so much that goes on. And yeah, I mean, so much of something like this, right? People don't even realize the economic impact that it has. Or for the family that really needs to get into a family court, you know, how this is opening up, this will open up some space instead of taking up valuable time for the courts. So it's pretty great. Well, Hannah, I really appreciate you coming on Political Contessa today and talking about these issues. And really, it's like, I hope that my listener understands like that all of these issues, right? When we talk about issues, even if you don't agree with us on the migrant crisis, right? And making sure that the border is secure and that we don't have what's going on, understand the impact to other people, right? It's the taxpayer that's paying for this, that's working. It's not the millionaire who this is impacting, right? It's the working class person. It's the elderly person or the veteran or the single mom who really is scraping by that isn't getting the services that they need. It's the families, the inner city families that aren't getting the services that they need. And so it's so much further than just let's be compassionate that someone's coming from a different country and they're seeking asylum. The millionaire's tax, the transfer tax, like those are taxes that are regressive because they're on everyone and they're on people who, if you bought your house for $30,000 and you're lucky enough to sell it for $2 million, you're not wealthy. You just hit the jackpot when you bought it 40 or 50 years ago.
And that may be your retirement nest egg.
Yep. And so there's a bigger impact on all of these things. And they're not as cut and dry, I think, as the media would like it to sound or other elected officials, Democrats would like to make it sound. So I appreciate you talking this through and showing, really kind of honing in on the economic impact of a lot of these things.
Well, thanks for having me. And thank you for having this podcast. It's so great. I listen all the time to hear what's going on. I love it when I hear some of our past friends working together on different things too that you're talking to, but you filled such a great void that we had in terms of this conversation. So thank you for doing it and for asking me to be a part of it today.
Aw, thank you. That makes my day. Well, good luck at the State House over the next couple of weeks and keep out there, keep fighting for us because we need you, Hannah. So thank you.
I will. Thanks, my friend.
All right. So I'm Jennifer Nassor. That was Hannah Kane, state representative from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. And this is Political Contessa. And thank you for listening to us here today. Stay happy, healthy, and safe.
Thanks so much for listening to Political Contessa. For all the ways to listen and to get the inside scoop on what's happening in center-right politics for women like us, head over to politicalcontessa.com.